the school has been, for many decades now, developing curriculum on effective advocacy, policy, and it didn't have a focus on LGBTQ rights or the global LGBTQ landscape. And it was ripe for that. How can we look at the existing community organizing and leadership work and tailor that for activists around the world so that they have access to it without having to pay $100,000 a year at Harvard?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Hong Kong's government teases limited queer spousal rights. Pope Leo echoes the same-gender couple blessing policy of Francis. And Harvard's global LGBTQI plus rights initiative faces Trump shutdown threats. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Marcos Najera.
And I'm Natalie Munoz.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 12, 2025. Same-gender couples in Hong Kong who have legal recognition from abroad could get health-related spousal rights under a new government proposal. The document specifically states that it is not equivalent to civil marriage rights. It is an effort by lawmakers to satisfy a landmark 2023 ruling by Hong Kong's Court of Final Appeal that ordered legal recognition for queer couples who have civil unions or marriages from foreign countries. One of the spouses must be a Hong Kong resident. The rights in the proposal are limited to mutual medical decision-making and the right to claim the deceased spouse's body and to decide if the remains can be used for medical education or research. The measure is far from a done deal, according to the South China Morning Post, however. So far, at least 41 of the 89-member Legislative Council have indicated their objection to the proposal. They include members from the Democratic Alliance for the Betterment and Progress of Hong Kong, the Business and Professionals Alliance, the Federation of Trade Unions, and the Liberal Party. Legislator Regina Ip Lau Suk Yi says that she and five other members of her New People's Party will support the proposal. She's the convener of the Key Decision-Making Executive Council. Queer advocates suggest that the measure should be postponed in the council so that public hearings and other consultations can allow time to develop sufficient legislative support for the proposal. Of course, Hong Kong officials can only push the envelope so far, considering mainland China's steadfast disapproval when it comes to queer issues. Even if it's a stretch, the proposal may not fully satisfy the Court of Appeal ruling. Pro-democracy and human rights activist Jimmy Sham fought a five-year legal battle to get that victory. As he told the Associated Press, "I hope the government will listen to opinions from society and the community and try to develop a solution that doesn't exceed society's acceptance level, while meeting the expectations of same-sex couples and avoiding legal challenges."
Pope Leo XIV is expected to maintain his predecessor's policy of allowing priests to bless same-gender couples. Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez of the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith was asked by a local reporter on July 3rd if Leo would reverse Pope Francis's position. Fernandez replied, "I don't think so. The declaration will remain," according to the National Catholic Reporter. That's not considered to be an official church statement. Pope Leo has told the Vatican diplomatic corps that he also reaffirms the Roman Catholic Church's refusal to hold ceremonies to recognize the marriages of same-gender couples. In his words, family is still founded upon the stable union between a man and a woman. That's also consistent with policies expressed by Pope Francis. As Cardinal Robert Prevost, Leo had a somewhat limited but mixed record on LGBTQ rights.
More than 100 transgender inmates in Tehran's infamous Evin prison are missing and presumed dead following Israeli airstrikes on June 23rd. Authorities in the Iranian capital confirmed that they were housed in the hardest-hit area of the prison. Officially, 79 people are known dead and dozens more injured. The casualties included guards, administrative staff, healthcare and social workers, a lawyer, visiting relatives, and nearby residents, including a 5-year-old child. Being transgender itself can be a criminal offense in Iran. Trans people can only be legally recognized after undergoing gender affirmation surgery. In many cases, they're considered mentally ill. There are no legal protections from hate crimes or discrimination. Evin Prison is the main facility for the Islamic Republic's political prisoners, problematic reporters and educators, and foreigners accused of spying. It has a documented history of deplorable living conditions and human rights abuses, such as beatings, torture, sleep deprivation, sexual assault, and lengthy solitary confinement. The bombing that killed the transgender inmates was described as a symbolic act of liberation by Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar, according to the New York Times.
North Carolina Governor Josh Stein vetoed bills this week targeting the rights of transgender people and programs promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. The bills targeted DEI policies at public universities and community colleges, secondary schools, and state and local government agencies. They also gave parents greater rights to challenge the availability of school library books. Democrat Stein called the Republican-backed measure mean-spirited. The transgender bill began as a bipartisan measure to curb sexual exploitation by enforcing age verification and consent rules for pornography websites. Lawmakers later added a ban on state-funded gender-affirming procedures for prisoners, followed by a provision affirming the recognition of only two genders. Stein said in his veto message that he strongly supported the original anti-sexual exploitation provisions in the bill, but that the final measure was a different story. Bucking the Trump administration and Republican state lawmakers, Stein wrote, "At a time when teachers, law enforcement, and state employees need pay raises and people need shorter lines at the DMV, the legislature failed to pass a budget and instead wants to distract us by stoking culture wars that further divide us. I stand ready to work with the legislature when it gets serious about protecting people and addressing North Carolinians' pressing concerns."
Wisconsin Supreme Court has narrowly voted to affirm the state's ban on conversion therapy. The 4-3 ruling decided that a Republican-dominated legislative committee had violated the state constitution by refusing to enforce an agency's rule that implemented the ban. Democratic Governor Tony Evers issued an executive order in 2021 that prohibited government funds from being used for conversion therapy, that much-debunked practice that aims to change sexual orientation or gender identity through psychological counseling and/or prayer. He filed suit against the state legislature in 2023 for obstructing basic government functions when the committee had previously tried to derail the ban. The High Court sided with Evers in its July 8th ruling, deciding that a legislative committee cannot block the implementation of an agency rule without the passage of specific legislation. Elections do have consequences. The Wisconsin Supreme Court's liberal majority survived a high-profile campaign in April that defeated multi-billionaire Elon Musk's outrageously expensive effort to install a Trump-supported jurist.
Finally, first the Trump administration came for transgender people. Now they're erasing bisexuals. All references to trans people were ordered removed from the Stonewall National Monument website in February. Now the same fate seems to have befallen bifolk. Earlier incarnations of the National Park Service hosted website highlighted what it called LGBTQ+ activism. That acronym was replaced by LGB. And now there were presumably only lesbian and gay people at the historic Stonewall riots of June 1969. 8 references to bisexuals on the site as of April of this year have been reduced to only 2, according to reports. Trans journalist Aaron Reed compared the original Stonewall National Monument website with the current one. She found that it was, before the 1960s, almost everything about living openly as a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer LGBTQ+ person was illegal. Now it's, before the 1960s, almost everything about living authentically as a gay or lesbian person was illegal. The Stonewall National Monument was created in 2016 by President Barack Obama as the first such site dedicated to the advancement of LGBTQ rights. Tanya Azapanza Johnson Walker reminded a crowd at the monument's physical site in New York City that queer people have been here since the beginning of time, according to Pink News. The trans activist told those protesting the disappearance of the full spectrum of the queer community, "We're here to stay, and we will not be erased by a Christo-fascist neo-Nazi administration."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending July 12, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Natalie Munoz. Stay safe.
I'm John Ritchie, author of City of Night, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I hope that you do stay tuned.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Fight, demonstrate to them our skill. Albeit they possess the might, nonetheless we have the will.
Will Harvard University have the will to fend off threats from the Trump administration to cut off federal research dollars and bar international students from enrolling? It's not just one school. It's a wide-ranging assault on higher education designed to break the commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Meanwhile, Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government is breaking new ground in its efforts to advance LGBTQ liberation in the U.S. and around the globe. The acclaimed public policy school's long-established Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights houses the global LGBTQI+ human rights program. That year-old program director is Diego Garcia Bloom. As Bloom tells This Way Out's David Hunt, the program has already done much to expand queer social research and to promote international activism through the power of storytelling.
Harvard University, the renowned Ivy League school on the banks of the Charles River outside of Boston, has dominated higher education in the United States for nearly 400 years. Since its founding in 1636. Among its alumni, Harvard boasts 8 U.S. presidents, over 150 Nobel laureates, 46 Olympic gold medalists, and 10 Academy Award winners. But it's only in the last 150 years or so that the college has been what American conservatives would call woke. The university reformed its curriculum in the late 19th century, moving away from its Puritan roots, introducing more elective courses and emphasizing scientific and modern subjects. The first black student earned a degree in 1870. Women were officially admitted as students during the Second World War, and the first openly gay professor came out in 1982. Another milestone in the school's long history of social progress came just a year ago, in May 2024, when the Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights, a think tank in the Harvard Kennedy School, launched the Global LGBTQI+ Human Rights Program. While Harvard battles the Trump administration in court to protect diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on campus, the Carr Ryan Center has kept its eyes on the prize, focusing on training and leadership development, research, public engagement, and partnerships, all aligned to advance the human rights of LGBTQ people, especially in parts of the world where those rights are threatened, disappearing, or non-existent. I'm David Hunt. I sat down with Diego Garcia Bloom, director of the Global LGBTQI+ Human Rights Program at the Carr Ryan Center, to discuss the program's accomplishments over its first year. The goal, he told me, is to empower this and the next generation of LGBTQ activists, to give them the benefits of a Harvard education without the sticker shock of Harvard tuition.
The school has been, for many decades now, developing curriculum on effective advocacy, policy, and it didn't have a focus on LGBTQ rights or the global LGBTQ landscape, and it was ripe for that. We had professors who had been working in the intersection of all the international bodies, including the UN, the Association of American States, all of the international bodies where LGBTQ activists were working, but no specific focus on LGBTQ work. And then also we had so much incredible content on advocacy and community organizing, which is the core and the root of how this work gets done around the world, that when I came to Harvard as a student, realized activists all over the world would benefit so, so much from being able to have access to this. And so I came in really trying to understand a couple of things as a student, actually. First, what can we learn from a research standpoint of where change has happened before and make frameworks, lessons, academic work out of that so that other activists don't have to reinvent the wheel every time, but rather have the takeaways from that work? And second, how can we look at the existing community organizing and leadership work and tailor that for activists around the world so that they have access to it without having to pay $100,000 a year at Harvard? And so that was the premise of the program. We brought together incredible faculty at the university to say, would you be willing to work with us to make this accessible to activists all over the world where they are? And they said yes. And we have over 33 affiliated faculty from all over the university that come together for our training programs now that have now over 80 participants in the year that we've been running and also in the pilot that we did before this.
In addition to this intensive six-month advocacy and leadership program, the Carr Ryan Center has its online Changemakers Network, a global community of 2,000 LGBTQ activists who participate in regular virtual training sessions on a wide range of topics.
When we were looking at what we could offer, we knew the really impactful kind of learning is being able to be in a space where you hear from others, where you're able to constantly interact with activists around the world. And so we wanted to create a community of learning where we could offer around twice or three times a month workshops that people could come together and around a specific topic, learn and share. And so we created the Global LGBTQI+ Changemakers Network. And this really is a community of learning where we, on a very constant basis, trainings and informational content that people come together to learn. But also not only that, it goes beyond just the learning to when we need some kind of research, interview some folks around the world for research, or maybe even if they have internships and we have some money for some Harvard students to intern somewhere. And so it's a community of folks working in the space that we rely on for research, for trainings, for learning for our students. And so it's around now 2,000 activists in 170 countries.
The Carr Ryan Center has a big online presence, producing podcasts, webinars, and virtual training programs attended by hundreds, sometimes thousands, of people. But it also believes in the effectiveness of face-to-face learning and discovery, its International LGBTQI Plus Activism Summit, held on campus in October 2024, brought together activists from 20 countries for an immersive learning experience. Participants worked with Harvard faculty to explore proven strategies for countering the myths used to oppress and stigmatize LGBTQ people around the world. When I spoke with him, Bloom had just returned from a trip to South America, where he conducted face-to-face training programs for scores of activists who hadn't been able to attend the summit in the United States. It was a chance for people on the front lines of social change to network and learn from Harvard research and from each other.
I was just in Rio, and one of the things that we did was we brought together leaders after an event. And one of the things that shocked me a little bit was the convening I did on my trip there was the first time many of these local leaders were meeting for the first time. And these were not only local, but people working in this space for a long time internationally at the UN. And they're like, yeah, we don't have many opportunities or forums to come together to discuss the work or our stories. And so one of the benefits and kind of the value added that our program has is being able to say, hey, let's bring the leaders together that are working in this space, but usually not interacting with each other. And let's convene, know each other. The social is just as important as movement and social movement. And in sharing our stories, we create also these new pathways to collaboration between them.
You were listening to This Way Out, the International LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Diego Garcia Bloom, director of the Global LGBTQI+ Human Rights Program at the Carr Ryan Center at Harvard. Bloom explained the leadership framework underlying much of the program's work, a framework based on the power of storytelling.
One of the main trainings that we lean on from the Kennedy School is Marshall Ganz's public narrative and community organizing work. And a big foundation in Colombia invited us to get activists together to go over this training. I'll tell you, the beauty of this training is it's about sharing our stories. And so the idea is that there is a three-part framework on how do we get people to have shared values into action. It's not enough that you may have a ton of people that believe in equality for LGBTQ people. That's not enough to get people into action. There is a leadership practice, and we call it public narrative, to be able to move people into action. And so that goes into three parts. Is the story of self. The story of self is, why am I here? Why am I doing this work? And it's important to give people that story to be able to root your leadership. The story of us is, what brings us together? What are our shared values and what are our challenges that we're facing together? And then the story of now is, and what are we going to do together now? And it's a practice that we teach in workshops. And so, for example, I go when I do this work and I say, you know, I grew up as a gay immigrant in the United States, bullied in school in an evangelical church that tried to put deep, deep shame in me. The bullying I experienced in school when I was in recess and the kids would call me names, would send me to cry to the bathroom. And I have that deep shame that I lived with for so long that characterized my upbringing. And it led me to a deep depression as an adolescent. And the reason why I do this work is because I do not want kids to go through that again. And so, for example, when I tell my story, people understand, I know why he does this work. He lived through that experience, and this is what motivates me. So we ask folks, why are you here? And sometimes they haven't even articulated that. And they say, one of the participants in one of the trainings that I did recently said, one day I had a homophobic neighbor who one day just came up to me and hit me. And then we start going through the stories that move people into action. And that's where you get their anchor. And then we say, you know, we've all experienced something like that, you know. And so the challenge that we have now is, how do we make a better world? And so that is the story of us. The story of us is I come with my experiences, you come with yours, but we have a shared challenge now. And then the story of now is, well, we have work to do. And what does that look like right now? And how do we move together into action?
In all its work with activists around the world, the Global LGBTQI+ Human Rights Program is committed to translating cutting-edge research into real-world action. The program supports 9 LGBTQ research fellows working in areas such as feminist theory, organizational development, the rise of authoritarianism, and the global anti-gender movement. I asked Bloom about the challenges of working in higher education, and particularly at Harvard, in the face of ongoing threats from the Trump administration.
Harvard is under attack. There are folks who see this work that we're doing and also the other programs around Harvard and want to change that and how we teach, who teaches it, and trying to stifle that academic freedom. So I'm just very grateful that the university took a stand to be able to teach what it wants, to be able to have academic freedom while being very strong under anti-Semitism task forces and work, because as we can see, there's been kind of this entryway of using anti-Semitism as a way to attack everything in the university, including LGBTQ work, including racial justice work, including all this academic work revolving around this. And so it's a fraught time. It should raise alarm bells everywhere. I would say, you know, everyone stand with Harvard. Stand with Harvard.
Last week, Harvard rebranded its student DEI office, renaming it the Office of Culture and Community. And it took down, at least for now, websites for its Women's Center, LGBTQ Student Life, and Intercultural Affairs. Are these the first steps toward a settlement with the Trump administration? Or is the university standing down in the face of White House pressure? Time will tell. I'd like to thank Diego Garcia Bloom at Harvard's Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights for speaking with me for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Marcos Najera and Natalie Munoz and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. Crosby, Stills & Nash, Tom Lehrer, and Logan Pilcher performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Hal Myers of Santa Fe, New Mexico, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WADR, Janesville, Wisconsin, CFMH, St. John, New Brunswick, KSXU, Seattle, Washington, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.